This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We are now dealing with issues that will demand a radical redistribution of economic and political power.
Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. calls for an end to systematic racism, poverty, and war in the U.S. during a speech at the University of California, Berkeley, May 17, 1967.
But now we're talking about something different. We're talking about desegregating the institutions of America. We're talking about changing the way that institutions work in relationship to racial equity and participation of all people in the whole of society.
Scholar activist Dr. M. Tangalizi Sanyika says Dr. King's speech was delivered during a tumultuous year in the 60s between King's middle and later phase.
And I would certainly say that some of the strongest support that we have received came from this great campus, this university, with students who have a great concern. And I want to thank you because you, in a real sense, have been the conscience of the academic community in our nation.
And Dr. King on the importance of the student movement. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. According to the King Center, Dr. King is widely regarded as America's preeminent advocate of nonviolence and one of the greatest nonviolent leaders in world history. During less than 13 years of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s leadership of the modern civil rights movement from December 1955 until April 4, 1968, African Americans achieved more progress toward racial equality in America than the previous 350 years had produced. Drawing inspiration for both his Christian faith and the peaceful teachings of Mahatma Gandhi, Dr. King led a nonviolent movement in the late 1950s and 60s to achieve legal equality for African Americans in the United States. He went on to lead similar campaigns against poverty and international conflict, always maintaining fidelity to his principles that men and women everywhere, regardless of color or creed, are equal members of the human family. Classic by John Coltrane, A Love Supreme. In a speech delivered on the steps of Sproul Hall at the University of California, Berkeley, with an audience of university students, faculty, and the public, Dr. King addressed the immoral consequences of the United States' involvement in Vietnam, the crippling effects of poverty in the nation, and the global impact of war. America's Moral Dilemma was recorded by the Pacifica Radio Archives, May 17, 1967. Our guest host, retired scholar, activist, and university professor, Baba Dr. M. Tangalizi Sanyika, was an activist organizer of the civil rights, peace, ecology, and black power movements. He says Dr. King's speech was delivered at a time in which the freedom movement had accomplished major success in desegregating America. The goal shifted to challenging white supremacy, institutional racism, inequality, poverty, and powerlessness. Here, he offers an analysis of the civil rights movement and the issues impacting the U.S. during the 60s.
Happy Martin Luther King's Day to each and every one of you. This is a good day. This is a wonderful day, a day that we should take some time to do some thinking and reflecting about the meaning and substance of this great man and what he left us with and what he had to share with us with his own life and legacy that may be impactful for all of us. Today, I'm going to share with you some ideas and some responses, some comments, a speech that he delivered in May of 1967 at the University of California, Berkeley Sproul Hall Plaza, before 7,000 mostly students. So one of the titles of that speech was, "You," referencing the students, "were the conscience of the academic community and our nation." He was saying to the students, "You were the conscience of our nation, and you were the conscience of your academic community, and you were the difference maker." That speech, which was delivered at that day and that time, was done so at the tumultuous time of 1967, that year that was right between the middle king of the middle 60s, who had already now accomplished the Voting Rights Act and Public Accommodations Act and March on Washington and all those great civil rights victories that we talk about. And now was in the era where the movement towards Black power was challenging he as well as all the previous civil rights thinking in the country. And that king was different from the earlier king, because now what that king is saying to us is it was easier to desegregate America. That didn't cost us very much to do that, to desegregate the lunch counters and the libraries and the buses and the stores. He said that didn't cost us very much. But now we're talking about something different. We're talking about desegregating the institutions of America. We're talking about changing the way that institutions work in relationship to racial equity and participation of all people in the whole of society, not just parts of society. And so this is a different place. This is a different location for where Dr. King was and what it is he was focusing on. And remember, this was at the height of the Vietnam War, that real, real, real difficult year for the whole of the country and for all social movements and for students, for governments, for activists, for faith-based organizations. The country was deeply, deeply, deeply being divided by this war in Vietnam. The war in Vietnam became the focal point of most of the energy of the social movement, eclipsing, some thought, the civil rights movement, which is why 59% of African Americans did not support Dr. King's position opposing that war. Some 85% of the rest of America also opposed him being engaged in support of the war. But he did so because, as he said, it was the right thing to do. It was the morally correct thing to do. So this speech is one that we like to study, we like to think about, we like to analyze what it is saying to us and what the implications were, because this is King at a different stage of his life than he had been previously in the movement for social justice. Now, as I said, the speech was delivered at the University of California, Berkeley Sproul Hall Plaza, before 7,000 mostly students. So one of the titles of that speech was, "You," referencing the students, "were the conscience of the academic community and our nation." First, Martin valued very highly the practice and the work and the integrity of the student movement. He saw in the student movement one of the great forces for change in America, because students were able to articulate clear positions and bring a lot of energy and a lot of discipline to changing the system itself. It was students who indeed were the base of the protest movement against the war in Vietnam all over the country, on campuses, everywhere. There were sit-ins and there were sleep-ins and there were pickets on campus. There were boycotts of classes. There were calls for boycotts of many of the businesses that were supporting Vietnam. It was a very active time for students in virtually all types of colleges and universities around the country. And Dr. King was one of their favorite representatives of the causes that they were engaging in. And so he had an organic connection to the students and was very active in supporting the work that they were doing, both within the civil rights movement directly and the anti-war movement, which had subsequently emerged. One of the things that makes that point relevant about this speech is that it's very similar to what we have just recently experienced in this country today, in which there has emerged and did emerge a student movement in protest of the Israeli war against the Palestinian civilians that we recently have seen, in which it appears as though many, many Palestinian lives were lost, some 44,000 or more were lost in that war, who were civilians. Some regard that as an immoral action, and certainly the International Court has even considered the actions of the Israeli military as affiliated with genocide in its own language. The students believe that it was immoral for the United States to provide weapons to the Israeli government to carry out its war functions, which were designed to wipe out the Gaza area of Palestine and make it uninhabitable for the residents there, on the theory that the antagonist in this war, the group called Hamas, was indeed being sheltered by many of the civilian structures and systems in Gaza, and thus it was necessary to do what the Israeli military did. But the students pointed out that this was immoral, no matter how you explained it, for us to provide the weapons for them to kill as many people as were killed, and that this war was an unjustifiable one. It was immoral, and it was illegal, just like we heard it in 1967. And so it was almost as though the voice of Martin was echoing over the protests that we had recently seen in this country about the question of war. And it became an issue in the election, especially in the state of Michigan, where we definitely know that many people voted for what they perceived to be a proposal for peace that one of the candidates had put forward. But we can simply say today that we are thankful that there has now been the initiation of a proposal for a ceasefire, and hopefully there will be a resolution of this historical and traditional conflict between those two regions of the country. But what Martin's emphasis with students tells us is that something was learned from that part of history. Something was learned about how a peace movement is put together and developed by students on our college campuses. And it's almost as though they were reproducing and repeating exactly the movement of students in the 1967 era. And so we see history repeating itself, and we see Martin's influence, I think, being exacted here and being shared to show that this was a problematic area. So that speech brings out again an issue that we are presently dealing with: war and student movements who show the immorality of our own behavior and why we should oppose that behavior and cease that behavior. We did not completely accomplish the cessation, but the moral issue was put on the table in a way that we have all seen the efficacy of the result. This is Dr. Mtangalizi Sanyika sharing perspectives on the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the occasion of his annual birthday celebration for capitalism, race, and democracy.
I think one of the great needs in our world today, and certainly in our nation, is for the revolution of values. And I, for one, appreciate the fact that you here at Berkeley have constantly reminded all of us and our whole nation that we must review our values. And I would also like to express my deep personal appreciation to you as a civil rights leader for the support that you, as a university and a concerned student body, have given to the civil rights struggle. As we have labored tirelessly and unrelentingly to achieve first-class citizenship, we have had the support of persons of goodwill over our nation, And I would certainly say that some of the strongest support that we have received came from this great campus, this university, with students who have a great concern. And I want to thank you, because you, in a real sense, have been the conscience of the academic community in our nation. And I can only say, keep up the good work and keep up this great concern. I want to talk with you this afternoon from the subject, America's Chief Moral Dilemma. Our nation suffers from a kind of poverty of the spirit, which stands in glaring contrast to our scientific and technological abundance. Yes, we've learned to fly the air like birds, we've learned to swim the seas like fish, and yet we have not learned the simple art of walking the earth as brothers and sisters. Henry David Thoreau talked once about improved means to an unimproved end. And so often, we have allowed the means by which we live to outdistance the ends for which we live. And it seems to me that this is expressed nowhere greater than in the continued existence of racism, poverty, and war. These are the three evils that I want to talk about this afternoon, evils that must be dealt with and problems that must be solved if we are to go on positively and creatively in the days ahead. Racial injustice is still the black man's burden and America's shame. This problem exists today because many Americans would like to have a nation which is a democracy for white Americans, but simultaneously a dictatorship over black Americans. This is one of the great problems that we find today. Now, in the struggle to get rid of racial injustice, there has been some progress, and I would not want to overlook this. For in assault after assault, the movement has profoundly shaken the entire edifice of legal segregation. And I need not go into the movements from the Montgomery bus boycott right on up through the Selma movement of 1965. Movements which literally subpoenaed the conscience of a large segment of the nation to appear before the judgment seat of morality on the whole question of civil rights. But in spite of this, we must recognize that the plant of freedom has grown only a bud and not yet a flower. We must see that the struggle is much more difficult now. For well now 12 years, the civil rights struggle dealt with the system of legal segregation and the syndrome of deprivation and exploitation surrounding this system. Many things were done during those years that we will remember as long as the cords of memory shall lengthen. But what we must see today is that with Selma and the Voting Rights Act, one phase of development in the civil rights revolution came to an end. Now a new phase has opened. And this new phase is a struggle for genuine equality. Now, in the phase that has now passed, the achievements were obtained at bargain rates. It didn't cost the nation anything to integrate lunch counters. No expenses were involved. No taxes were involved. It didn't cost the nation anything to integrate libraries, motels, and hotels. It didn't cost the nation anything to guarantee the right to vote. Now we are dealing with issues that will cost the nation something in terms of billions of dollars. And the other thing that we must see is that we are now dealing with issues that will demand a radical redistribution of economic and political power.
Terry Lynn Carrington, Money Jungle, originally recorded by Duke Ellington. This is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I am Akua Holt. Today we are playing excerpts of Dr. King's speech from the Pacifica Radio Archives with commentary by retired scholar activist Dr. M. Tangalizi Sinyika. He was a university professor and an activist organizer with the civil rights, peace, ecology, and Black Power movements. He has taught at 12 different universities on Africana studies, community development, and public policy. He knew and or worked with many movement leaders, including Dr. King, John Lewis, Shirley Chisholm, Howard Zinn, Stokely Carmichael, aka Kwame Ture, and many others. Here's Dr. Sinyika on Dr. King's analysis regarding racism and poverty in the U.S.
Dr. King said that there were three basic evils that we had to fight, racism, poverty, and war. And he was saying to us that the way he saw it, we did have to move towards fighting systemic racism in America's institutional culture, wherever we found it. And that is how the movement itself began to understand that the fight that we were engaged in was deeply rooted in the fabric, in the institutions of American society. And so the fight against racism had to take on a new shape and a new form. But the nonviolent dimension of it was still there, but the institutional dimension of it became the new focus and the need for power to go with that. And so we learned something new and different in that part of the speech. The other thing is, a fourth point that came out of this was the emphasis on poverty. We don't hear too much about poverty today the way we used to when there was something called a war on poverty. But it was in this period, you know, and in this speech that Dr. King mentioned the need for us to focus on the elimination of poverty in the country. During his era, about one in every five people in the country were technically in poverty. Today, it's maybe one out of every eight, but it's still, you know, close to 40 million people in this country today who are still in poverty. So it's a substantial problem. The day that he was living in, it was extremely evident that there was a deep problem in the country with how resources were distributed, how goods and services were distributed, and how people were trapped, unable to move of the systems of poverty. The civil rights movement impacted those numbers and those percentages, and poverty we thought was declining over time. But today we still have close to 40 million people in the category of impoverished persons, and that is an extremely high number. But as he says to us, whatever the number is, he says, this is a country that can build skyscrapers, we can build airplanes, we can build good sound health systems, we can provide people with the fundamental basics of life because we have the resources, capacity, and know-how to do that. We can provide people with good, clean air, water, food. This is a country that does not have to have an impoverished population. It's not a necessity of life because we have an abundance in this country, he was saying, of what is needed for everyone to have a good quality of life. And that's part of what he was saying about poverty in America, that a good quality of life is something this country can offer and provide, and it is not a necessity. In some other countries, it may be a little different, but he saw that as a contradiction. And inside of this speech, you know, you see that as well as in other pieces of his analysis. This is Dr. Mtangalizi Sanyika sharing perspectives on the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the occasion of his annual birthday celebration for capitalism, race, and democracy.
Now, the second evil that I would like to mention is the evil of poverty. Like a monstrous octopus, it extends its nagging, prehensile tentacles in villages and cities all over our nation. Some 40 million of our brothers and sisters are poverty-stricken. Many of them go to bed hungry at night. I've seen them with my own eyes. I've lived with them in the ghettos of our nation. Some of them are Indians. Some are Mexican-American. Some are Puerto Rican. Some are Appalachian whites. The largest group in terms of, in proportion to its size in the population, is the American Negro. Negroes and poor people generally find themselves today smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society. Now, something must be done about this. Something must be done about it quickly. When we look at the Negro community, for an instance, we are facing a major depression every day. The unemployment rate among Negroes is set forth by the Labor Department at 8.4%. Unemployment in the nation general is about 4%. But they don't deal with all of the facts because they are dealing with statistics that can be gathered as a result of people who've been in the labor market and those who still go to the employment office to try to find work. They aren't dealing with the hundreds and thousands of discouraged Negroes, many of whom have lost hope. They've had so many doors closed in their faces. They've come to conclude that life is a long and desolate corridor with no exit sign. They've lost motivation. There may be another 7 or 8% in that category, which means that the unemployment rate among Negroes may well be 16%. Among some young people, among the youth In the Negro community, in some cities, it goes up as high as 35% and 40%. If the nation as a whole confronted what the Negro is presently confronting economically, we would be in a major depression more staggering than the depression of the 30s. And it's not only unemployment. Most of the poor people are working every day, but earning so little money, they cannot begin to gain the basic necessities of life. Something must be done about this. Ultimately, a great nation is a compassionate nation. Ultimately, a great person is concerned about the least of these. And I contend that we still have poverty in America today because there are still all too many people who are trying to be conscientious objectors in the war against poverty. There's somewhere else we ought to be conscientious objectors, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, but not in the war against poverty. The problem is, you see, we have the resources in America to end poverty. The question is whether we have the will. And if we are to end poverty, there must be a tremendous reordering of priorities. Senator Harkey estimated the other day that we spend $500,000 to kill every enemy soldier in Vietnam. And when you look at the other side, it's tragic. We spend only $53 a year for every person that's considered poverty-stricken. And half of that goes for salaries for those who are not poor. The question is, what are we trying to win today? I'm afraid that the administration of our nation is more concerned about winning an unwinnable war in Vietnam than about winning the war against poverty right here at home.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody load it. Turn me round, keep on a walking, yeah. Keep on a talking, marching up to freedom, yeah.
Ain't gonna let segregation, Lord.
Turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let segregation, Lord. Turn me round, keep on a walking, yeah. Keep on a talking, yeah. Marching up to freedom, yeah.
Ain't gonna let no jailhouse, Lord.
Turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let no jailhouse. Turn me round, keep on a walking, keep on a talking, marching up to freedom, yeah.
Ain't gonna let no nervous Nelly, Lord.
Turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let nervous Nelly, Lord. Turn me round. Keep on a walking, yeah, yeah. Keep on a talking, yeah. Marching up to freedom, yeah.
That was music by the Freedom Singers. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I am Akua Holt, along with our guest co-host, Dr. Imtiazlizi Senyika. Next, Dr. Senyika offers his final analysis of Dr. King's speech on war and militarism, stating, among the triple evils along with racism and poverty, maintaining these three evils serve the interests of the American power elite, but not its people. Adding, quote, if Martin were alive today, he would be with the justice movements of our time, and that is Dr. King's enduring and eternal legacy, unquote.
Another aspect of the speech that is still relevant to us today is his statement about war as that other part of the triple evil, though he also added militarism as a component of it. and was contending that we should not build our society based on war and militarism, but rather on peace and humanity, and that the way to build a society should be based on human relations and human development and goodness and rightness in relationships with compassion and empathy for each other and one another. Dr. King believed very strongly and powerfully that humanity, in all humanity, was created equal and was endowed with certain rights that were human and created, and thus no one should be denied of those fundamental rights. But he did believe that the way to develop a society was based on peace and not on war. And he saw war as one of the evils in society, and felt that it was one of the things that we all had to fight against in terms of the American story.
Now this leads me to the next evil. It is the evil of war. Nowhere does this evil expressed today more than in the tragic, unjust, evil war in Vietnam. It's tragic that we got in it from the very beginning. As Professor Cominger has said, this tragic war is a product of a gigantic miscalculation that the world after 1945 was and would remain divided into two great blocks, one representing light and the other darkness, and that we who represented the light stood at Armageddon and battled for the Lord. Somehow we moved right on with those miscalculations. This war is the product of a gigantic miscalculation about China and about Asia, probably the largest and most fearful miscalculation in diplomatic history. The notion that Chiang Kai-shek represented the true China, that the communists did not represent China, and were not really here to stay and need not therefore be recognized. It was as if Britain and France had gone on recognizing the Confederacy as the legitimate government of the United States 20 years after Appomattox. It is the product of an almost demonic delusion that we were not only called upon to set and keep the rest of the world straight, but that we had the material, intellectual, and moral resources to do this. It is a product of grave miscalculations that because we were a world power, we had power and could use it everywhere in the world. Out of this melancholy body of obsessions and miscalculations have come those notions now so familiar that we, not the United Nations, are the peacekeeping instrument of the modern world. Once accept these assumptions, assumptions almost paranoid in their sweep and vastness, and our war in Vietnam takes on a kind of nightmarish logic. This war has all of the dimensions of a Greek tragedy. You know, it has done so much damage to our nation. As a result of this war, we have seriously impaired the United Nations. We have forfeited the support of our allies. And so today the United States stands morally and politically isolated in the world. We have greatly strengthened the forces of reaction in our country and excited violence and hatred among our people. We have strengthened the military-industrial complex, which even President Eisenhower once warned us against. Then we have blocked the self-determination of a people. And whether people in our country realize it or not, in large numbers, we are in the tragic position in the war in Vietnam of engaging in a process that perpetuates white colonialism covered up with certain niceties of complexity. Another casualty of the war in Vietnam is the humility of our nation. Through rugged determination, scientific and technological progress, as I mentioned earlier, we have become the richest and most powerful nation in the world. But honestly impels me to admit that our power has often made us arrogant. We feel that our money can do anything. We arrogantly feel that we have everything to teach other nations and nothing to learn from them. We often arrogantly feel that we have some divine messianic mission to police the whole world. We are arrogant in not allowing young nations to go through the same growing pains, turbulence, and revolution that characterized our own history. We are arrogant in our contention that we have some sacred mission to protect people from totalitarian rule while we make little use of our power to end the evils of South Africa and Rhodesia. We are arrogant in professing to be concerned about the freedom of foreign nations while not setting our own house in order. Many of our senators and congressmen vote joyously to appropriate billions of dollars for the war in Vietnam. And these same senators and congressmen vote loudly against a fair housing bill to make it possible for a Negro veteran of Vietnam to purchase a decent home. We arm Negro soldiers to kill on foreign battlefields, but offer little protection for their relatives from beatings and killings in our own South. We are willing to make the Negro 100% of a citizen in warfare, but reduce him to 50% of a citizen on American soil. So of all the good things in life, the Negro has approximately one half those of whites. Of the bad things, he has twice those of whites. Thus, half of all Negroes live in substandard housing, and Negroes have half the income of whites. When we turn to the negative experiences of life, the Negro has a double share. There are twice as many unemployed. The infant mortality rate is double that of white. There are twice as many Negroes dying in Vietnam as whites in proportion to their size in the population. And all of this tells us that our nation has a great deal to do in using its vast resources of power to solve the problems facing our nation and facing mankind. And the other thing about this war in Vietnam is that it has increased the possibilities of all-out nuclear warfare, and therefore it has increased the possibilities of the destruction of all mankind. And I must say to you honestly this afternoon, and I'm sad to say it, but I fear that the clouds the Third World War are hovering mighty low. And if there is a Third World War which can destroy the whole of mankind, our government will have to take the chief responsibility for making this a reality.
Standing for freedom, freedom till he comes, 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 standing for freedom, freedom till he comes,
Sweet honey in the rock, let there be peace. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Today we are playing excerpts of Dr. King's speech from the Pacifica Radio Archives with commentary by retired scholar activist Dr. M. Tangalizi Sanyika. He was a university professor and an activist organizer with the civil rights, peace, ecology, and Black Power movements.
The summary of all of that speech and what we learned from it is that Dr. King continued to remind us all that we needed to continue the fight against racism, but elevate that struggle to systemic racism, to institutional racism, that we needed to look at how we could continue the fight against poverty. We needed to look at issues of redistribution of power and wealth so that those would be potentially more democratic, but that the fight against poverty was an inherent part of our overall struggle for justice and for liberation and for peace and for equality. And he reminded us that war was not the way of life. It was not the way of the world. Nor was militarism, that there was nothing equitable or just about that for Black people in particular, but for any human beings at all. Indeed, he was a strong advocate of peace. And he reinforced for us the value of what students do in social movements. And we just saw that with this war in Gaza. And we definitely know that Dr. King was one of the great advocates of our time in the 20th century, that it was he who helped all of us to understand how this country continues to move towards democracy and how those who have been left out and marginalized must be included if there is to be a future for democracy. He did tell us that we've gotten stuck in Cold War battles in the past, and fights against totalitarianism. That sounds like he was saying a little bit of something to us with this challenge we have today about authoritarianism. He was definitely not an authoritarian supporter, but indeed was a Democrat with a small d, believing in democracy and justice, you know, for all human beings and all people. And so there is the insight that he shares there in this speech, as we also find elsewhere in many of his speeches, that his respect for democracy, for all human beings, and a respect for the rule of law as the way that this society should develop and should be governed. So this was one of his great speeches that taught us many lessons. We have to assess it in relationship to the other speeches that he had made and learn how we can assess him in all three phases of his life, the early phase, the middle phase, and the later phase. And this speech Vietnam speech made in Berkeley, California in 1967 was made in the later phase when the society was in tumult. And he was one of the beautiful spirits that tried to help us see the way and find the way, and letting us know and reminding us that our students were our moral conscience was a good way to do that. So this contributes to his life and his legacy. May they be praised. This is Dr. Mtangulizi Sanyika sharing perspectives on the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the occasion of his annual birthday celebration for capitalism, race, and democracy.
The Prince of Peace, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., born Michael King Jr. on January 15, 1929, was killed by an assassin's bullet at 39 years old on April 4, 1968. He was fatally shot while standing on the balcony at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. Dr. King later died at St. Joseph's Hospital in Memphis. He was the second of three children born to Michael King Sr. and Alberta King. He married Coretta Scott on June 18, 1963, on the lawn of her parents' home in Alabama. Mrs. Scott King transitioned at 78 on January 30, 2006. They had four children, Yolanda King, Martin Luther King III, Dexter Scott King, and Bernice King. Yolanda transitioned in May of 2007 at 51 years old, and Dexter sadly passed away last year in January 2024 at the age of 62. Visit the King Center to find out more about the beloved community mindset at thekingcenter.org.
Black man in a white man's world, where Jim Crow lived and hatred swirled, but people followed him into the street, marching and singing in the southern heat. He said the river is rising, won't be long. River is rising, big and strong. Coming down from the mountain in a mighty stream. River is rising, I have a dream.
They raise their voices, you could hear them calling. They were done with waiting, tired of stalling, demanding justice and a piece of the pie, not just the crumbs or another lie. He said the river is rising, won't be long.
New music and a King tribute by Moss Henry. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced and co-edited by me, Akua Holt, with contributions from scholar activist Dr. Mtangulizi Sanyika. Special thanks to our senior editor, Paulina Vasiliev, and the Pacifica Radio Archives. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I leave you with this quote. In the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.